History of Persia is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 124, All Hail the New Gods. Alright, some quick notes before I get panicked accusing emails. I made a bit of a mistake in planning out the first quarter of 2024. I wanted to launch Secret Wars in February, like I've said before. Getting ready for that burned through any prep I had on this show, but that was fine. Nothing ever happens in March, right? I mean, sure, I started a job that gets busy during heavy travel seasons, but I started in the deep end with the holidays. I could handle it. Wrong. It turns out that spring break season in the US is the single busiest time of the year for my new job, and on top of that, my brother came home from the Navy for the first time in 3 years. So I had to travel for that, and my parents' house isn't exactly conducive to podcast recording. I was able to get one out, but it was a Secret Wars podcast that, if you listen to it, you'll see could only really be recorded in that scenario anyway. The only reason Secret Wars was able to post is because I've had those episodes on deck since Christmas. So, basically, mea culpa, I apologize for the delay. The good news is that we are moving on, and I am a little better prepared for that. Alexander has finally found the one enemy he couldn't conquer. Getting sick. So I figured it's time to start transitioning into the next phase of our overall story. A world where Greco-Macedonian rule is the norm, starting with a basic explanation of ancient Greek religion and its gods. However, that also means we are entering the Hellenistic period, which is by far the greatest single cultural and political shift we will encounter until the very end of this podcast. It also means that we are branching a bit beyond my typical expertise. The Achaemenids were the reason I started this show in the first place. And with the likes of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes now in the past, I need to realign myself before I can totally reframe this podcast. There is also a truckload of back-end stuff that still needs done, but you don't need to worry about that immediately. Basically, I want to buy myself some time, but without going on a months-long hiatus to do research. So to do that, I'm going to be releasing some non-standard episodes for the next few weeks. These will mostly be conversational episodes where I chat with friends and fellow podcasters about ancient Persian history and related topics. Depending on how much time I need, I might throw in a few episodes approaching Achaemenid topics from new angles, and when we return, it will be time to properly usher in the era of Hellenization. So all of that will come right after the AMA in the next episode. But today, we should start with the fact that religion is almost an inaccurate word for Greek theology. The ancient Greeks were obviously religious in the sense that they almost universally had a shared set of spiritual beliefs and practices. But the idea of a specific religion was a foreign concept in many polytheistic ancient societies. Unlike most major modern religions, or the Zoroastrian beliefs that I usually talk about on this show, ancient Greek religion was not a revealed faith. There was no core set of texts and hymns composed by a singular, identifiable, divinely inspired prophet and their followers. The gods and the stories about them were just part of the culture, which spread and changed freely across the wider Greek world from the Atlantic all the way to India. At least now that Alexander really got that going. There was no original version of the myth that everybody agreed on back in the day. There are just the versions that got more and less popular, and which version that was changed dramatically over time. As a very basic example, if you know anything about Greek mythology, you've probably heard of the 12 Olympian gods, the dozen most important, or maybe most powerful, or most popular gods from ancient Greek culture. But even ancient lists don't actually agree on their roster. 6 to 8 of them are usually pretty consistent. But the rest varied from shrine to shrine, temple to temple, and even between time periods. The fun thing about this is that not only can you find an example where basically any generalization made about Greek religion is wrong, but we are entering a period where almost all aspects of Greek society changed or incorporated new elements from the people conquered by Alexander. So anything I say now may not be entirely accurate, even as a generalization, in 10 to 20 episodes. So let's do some generalizing. To the ancient Greeks, their gods were not omnipotent or omniscient, though they knew almost everything about what we mortals were up to, they could still be surprised and overcome. Depending on the context, some people seemed to view them as selectively omnipresent, able to manifest everywhere and anywhere, but not actually present at all times. Though immortal in the sense that they lived forever, the Greeks did have stories of gods killing other gods, and even the divine were subservient to the overwhelming force of fate, which the Greeks saw as the true governing force in the cosmos. More importantly, the Greek gods were not benevolent. They were every bit as fickle, conniving, jealous, and flawed as the people who worshipped them. Sometimes, if a storm destroyed your crops, you could see that as punishment for something you did. Other times, it just happened because the gods were jerks. Even in their most popular stories, the gods are just as likely to give you a supernaturally powerful weapon as they are to sleep with your wife. Sometimes, often, both. These gods were frequently the personification of different aspects of nature or culture. Different gods governed everything from wine and parties to the sky and storms, to medicine, to the arts, to individual rivers and mountains. And the extra fun part is, sometimes these beliefs originated in one place and spread to places where a different god was associated with the same thing. So over time, many, many Greek gods started overlapping, and it became much more about which one was more popular, either for festivals or stories or just vibes. There are two big problems in any attempt to describe Greek religious practices, more so than their actual beliefs. One, as I said, is the total lack of uniformity. there was no specific clergy in their own little caste of society like the Magi in Iran or the Brahmins in India or even the Levites in Judea. So practice varied as a rule. However, the general outlines of what practices were used are mostly universal in the Greek world. So even though they would be deployed in different contexts, every Greek knew what a writer was talking about when they described a particular type of ceremony or sacrifice, meaning that the writers didn't think their audience needed a detailed description, and in turn, modern readers have very little context for what is being described. Gods help you if you're talking about a well-known religious event, too, because then they just assumed the audience already knew most of the details. One misconception, or maybe misunderstanding, that I've noticed over the years and even tried to dispel on this show is that ancient polytheisms functioned like competing monotheistic religions most people know today. Of the major world religions these days, Hinduism is the closest to the dominant system of belief in antiquity. Even then, via exposure to monotheistic and revealed religions, Hinduism has become wildly insular compared to most ancient polytheisms. Unlike a revealed monotheistic religion like Christianity or Islam, ancient Greeks did not see their way as the only possible truth, and they were happy to assimilate foreign gods and traditions as they went. Sometimes these were treated as the same gods going by different names. Other times they were just new divine beings that could offer aid. The same is broadly true for Roman, Celtic, Mesopotamian, Egyptian, etc., etc. As usual, Achaemenid-era Zoroastrianism seems to fall somewhere in the middle. Mostly insular, but not entirely resistant to adopting foreign names and practices for their divinities. And like all religions, exposure to new philosophies introduced new interpretations of existing beliefs. But this is an episode about Greek religion. Modern understanding of a separate, competing religion was actually so unusual in ancient history that many languages didn't really have a word for religion as a specific, unique set of beliefs. The Latin word religio meant something more like scruples or obligations, depending on context, and only developed a specific sense of religious practice over the course of Rome's imperial period. The nearest Greek equivalent, thrakeia, referred to the act of religious practices, but didn't imply an in-group or an out-group. Though he was writing about Roman beliefs, a first-century author named Marcus Terentius Varro created what is, in my opinion, the best synopsis of ancient Mediterranean religion, the Tria Genera Theologiae, or the Three Ways of Understanding the Gods. The most obvious, as an observer, was Kiwile, civil religion practiced in public and sponsored by the state. I suspect this is what a lot of people imagine when thinking about ancient religion. It includes public holidays, sacrifices, grandiose temples, and other public displays. These are generally the obvious examples in archaeology. Then there is physikon, which you could literally translate as physics, but only in the archaic sense of any study of the natural world. This was the underpinning concept of using philosophy to try and understand how the world works, and in the religious context, how to attribute those workings to the gods. Finally, there's mythikon, which Varro described as all things which are attributed to the gods, and is actually a sort of catch-all for two categories that modern people would probably consider separate. Mythicon, in Varro's conception, included what most of us today think of as personal religious practice, like private prayer, rituals in the home, and other individual acts of superstition to appease the gods. It also included smaller acts of community worship, like ceremonies at village shrines or the famous mystery cults, a subject that I will have a lot more to say about in future episodes. Mythicon also includes what you are probably expecting, mythology. Both words coming from the Greek word mythos, meaning speech or story. This is all those tales of heroes, gods, and monsters that have been immortalized in storybooks since the earliest known examples of Greek literature and are still retold over and over today. So now, we come to the part where I actually have to dig into one of these genre of theology. And only one, because if I tried to cover them all, we'd be here for a month. So, when we come back from an ad break, I am going to go over some mythicon, mostly so I can get it out of the way. I routinely wish that I knew more languages. Even right in the middle of the US, I run into Spanish speakers all the time, and my social media always has a little Persian, Arabic, some Dutch, and German. Rosetta Stone does help. It's the most trusted language learning program, after all. It's also conveniently available on desktop or on the go as an app, and has some really cool features that truly immerse you in the language you're learning. Just the first steps, like learning a new alphabet and some simple phrases, helped open new doors, and Rosetta Stone is a great choice as the trusted expert in this for 30 years and millions of users with 25 languages available to learn. They focus on fast language acquisition, without English translations to help you learn, speak, listen, and think in your new language while building long-term retention. Their true accent speech recognition also gives feedback on pronunciation, which can be really important for languages like Persian, where how you say something is very important. And on top of being available for desktop and mobile, you have the option to download lessons and take them offline. This is also all available at a steal. You can get lifetime membership, all 25 languages, for 50% off. Don't put off learning that new language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, History of Persia listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today. Okay, we are back, we are talking about mythology, and it occurs to me that I might have given the impression that I don't want to talk about Greek myths. Much to the contrary, I could make just this section its own podcast, at least as long as the whole history of Persia, and I would be a very happy man. Greek mythology was my single biggest entry point into actually studying ancient history, courtesy of the Percy Jackson Mythology Bee when I was 12. So, thanks, Uncle Rick. However, I've had a problem with Greek mythology for the last 118 or so episodes. I can't just assume everyone listening knows the gods. I'm certain just about everyone knows a few of them, but at this point, it's getting really tedious to quickly explain the gods every time they come up. So what I'm gonna do now is provide a quick primer on some of the most important Greek gods who will come up on this show. And as I said earlier, that doesn't mean specifically the 12 Olympians, because that group was largely arbitrary in the first place. There are a few constants in the many versions of Greek myths that were told over the millennia. But the simplest one is that the gods lived on Mount Olympus, simultaneously a literal mountain in northern Greece, and a vague sense of a separate divine realm associated with that mountain. The other broadly consistent feature is the theogony, the origin of the gods. Even this runs into misconceptions driven by modern people trying to stick everything in distinct categories and look for an original text. And there is at least one alternative theogony that will be a big deal for this show. But we'll get to that when we come to it. The basic story is that long, long ago, at a point in the past when it's not even particularly clear if people existed yet, the universe was ruled by a group of gods called Titans. The King Titan was Kronos, not to be confused with Chronos, the godly form of the concept of time, although even ancient people mix them together constantly. Kronos and his queen Rhea had 5 children, but fearing that he would be overthrown, Kronos ate them at birth, all save the youngest, Zeus. Exact details vary from author to author, but Rhea hid Zeus away until he was full grown and could challenge his father. Zeus rescued his siblings from Kronos' gut, and together they waged war against the Titans, eventually rising to become the gods ruling the world. Zeus became king of the gods and claimed mastery over the skies and storms, wielding lightning bolts as his weapon of choice. He was typically presented as an even-handed, if fickle, dictator of the cosmos, occasionally challenged by his fellow gods, but always triumphant. Zeus married his sister Hera, because ancient mythological royalty and actual royalty played by the same rules. Hera was the goddess of marriage, households, and motherhood, but also occasionally of young women in general and virgins in particular. You will notice a theme with those two things. Mythologically, she was the consummate loyal queen, constantly trying to get retribution for Zeus's many affairs, but unable to rebel against her husband, so she took vengeance against the other women and their children, who were just as likely to be victims of assault as not, because Zeus was the archetype of an all-powerful king with all of the flaws that entails. Their brother, Poseidon, is best known as a god of the seas, but is a good first example of what a grab bag of features ancient Greek gods could actually be, since he was also in charge of earthquakes, the creator of horses, and a god of storms, where he overlaps with Zeus. Generally, Poseidon is a god that feels like he should be a bigger deal in actual mythology than literature portrays him. This may be because in his very early mythology, mostly lost to us today, Poseidon was portrayed as the king of the gods, or the god of the underworld. As a mythological character, he's not nearly as prominent as other gods, but as a god of seas and earthquakes in Greece, of all places, he was one of the most important gods to actually worship, which does paint a strange dichotomy between archaeology and literature. The third brother was Hades, who was, contrary to the Disney version and some early Christian theft of his name, not Satan. Generally, Hades' mythology characterizes him somewhere between apathetic and a benevolent tester. He was the king of the afterlife and governor of all the riches beneath the earth. Both very important things to honor him for religiously, but also stuff that made him generally creepy in a lot of mythology, and generated taboo around actual practices. It also makes him the antagonist to a lot of mythological heroes, as a convenient representative for the concept of death. And what's more impressive for a hero than overcoming death itself? Suck it, Alexander. One of Hades' most famous myths was him abducting, assaulting, and tricking the goddess Persephone into being tied to the underworld as Hades' wife. Persephone was the daughter of Zeus and another of his and Hades' sisters, Demeter. Demeter and Persephone are an interesting pair. The myth continues that Persephone is able to return to the world above for half the year, but when she is in the underworld, plant life withers and dies because of her mother's distress at her absence. This is given as the explanation for the changing of the seasons. It also gives Persephone and Demeter an odd role as goddesses of both plant life, fertility, and abundance, but also death, decay, and hard times. Persephone is usually presented as the raw, natural beauty of nature, while Demeter is more closely associated with agriculture and cultivation. Together, they were the chief goddesses of the Eleusinian Mysteries, a cult north of Athens and one of the most popular sects of personal religion in the Greek world. The fifth and final sibling, I'm only including because I mentioned the number five earlier, is the least important for our purposes, but very important for household religion. Hestia, patron of the hearth and home, believed to be a perpetual virgin who guarded and supported Greek family life. Now, things get more complicated, because not all of the gods identified as members of the 12 Olympians are particularly important to this show. For example, Hephaestus, god of craftsmen and metalworking, is always on the list, but he won't get much airtime. Whereas Hermes, god of travelers and trickery, was a big deal in Hellenistic Egypt, but spoiler, we will be saying goodbye to the Nile pretty soon. The vast majority of the gods on today's roster are children of Zeus, but as the god of philandering kings and problematic power dynamics, Hera is going to feel pretty left out. So it only seems fair that we start with the one and only god on here that is actually Zeus and Hera's son. That would be Ares, conveniently described as the god of war and sometimes of courage or bravery, but those descriptions are misleading at best. Ares was a god to be both feared and respected, because when he is described as a god of war, that means the terrifying, violent aspect of war. And when he is a patron of bravery, it is bravery in the face of that horror. So he was often honored with sacrifices and ceremonies before the declaration of war or the start of a battle, but that was more to appease the god than to ask for his help. You didn't want Ares to help. In myths, his charioteers are Deimos and Phobos, literally dread and fear. However, we are also entering an interesting era in Greek, or at least Hellenistic, understandings of Ares. As the conquests of Alexander brought Greek gods into contact with more and more cultures, they started encountering an odd phenomenon. Male war gods who weren't just respected for the bad part of war, but also for the honor and valor associated with battle. Most famously, this included the Roman god Mars, associated more with strategy and military planning than traditional Ares. In Iran and Central Asia, Ares was compared with Verethragna, the warrior Yezada who represents victory and the ideal warrior. As a result of these comparisons, Greek descriptions of Ares started becoming more respectable. Ares also leads us to two goddesses. First up, I'll get Aphrodite out of the way, since she has come up before and will never go away, since she's typically the Greek goddess on the Ishtar continuum of divinities associated with love, sex, relationship, conflict, fertility, and water. It's borderline impossible in the Hellenistic period to identify where the genuine Greek Aphrodite ends and comparisons to foreign goddesses begin. It will probably be easier to just address different aspects of her mythology as they come up. But she fits in here as Ares' lover, the mother of fear and dread in some stories. I won't dwell on it today, because we've got a lot to get through, but if you like mythology, this is also a good point to suggest digging into some of the stories, especially about Aphrodite and which other gods she connects to. Ancient writers spent a lot of time connecting the goddess of love in myths with other divinities in very interesting ways that say a lot about how they are perceived, the concept of love itself, like making love have an extramarital affair with war. The other goddess connected with Ares is Athena, lady of wisdom, crafts, cleverness, strategy, and tactics. In part because of her association with the city of Athens, she represented the baseline of success for a Greek city-state, both in the sense of products for export, wit in negotiation, and success in warfare. In mythology, Athena is typically presented as vengeful but not rash, always calculating, confident, and successful. She, like Hera, is often a patron of heroes, providing them with the tools and divine inspiration to overcome great obstacles. Her shield was emblazoned with the terrifying snake-haired Gorgon's head, which inspired fear in her opponents and was sometimes given or shared with her father, Zeus. And Alexander the Great supposedly carried a replica of that shield into battle. Athena's relationship to Zeus is also an interesting aspect of her mythology that often played a role in how Greeks understood this goddess, and goddesses in general to a certain degree. In the most popular version, Zeus receives a prophecy that his child by Metis, the Titan goddess of wise rule, would be a daughter who would one day have a son who would be even wiser than either of his forebearers and overthrow Zeus himself. In desperation, Zeus followed in his own father's footsteps and swallowed Metis whole before she could give birth. However, like Zeus's siblings in Kronos, Metis was not killed or destroyed, but she gave birth and raised Athena to adulthood inside Zeus's head, even crafting armor and weapons for the newborn goddess, eventually giving Zeus such a headache that he had his head split open with an axe, allowing Athena and Metis out into the world. As a compromise, Athena swears to be a perpetual virgin, seeing another war between the gods as unwise. The message is clear. Maintaining the status quo was seen as the peak of wisdom, but only because wisdom is greater than raw royal power. Athena and Zeus are also commonly associated with Nike, as in Nike, the inspiration for the name of the shoes. Nike was victory, as in the literal divine manifestation of the concept. Greek mythology is littered with these godly forms of raw ideas, much like the Yezadas. Usually, these are portrayed as gods from earlier lineages of divine beings that predate the conventional gods, though some, like Ares and Aphrodite, fit into a sort of middle category between the mythological character gods and the divine manifestation gods. Nike is just one child of Styx, the goddess of the river that marks the borders of the afterlife, and Pallas, the concept god of warcraft, whose name is also a frequent epithet for Athena herself. However, in part because she is just the most desirable part of war, Nike was the most frequently worshipped of her siblings. She was a companion to Zeus and Athena in battle. In Athens, their massive idol statue of Athena held Nike, literal victory, in her outstretched hand, offering it to anyone with the power to take it. Then there's the twin archers, Artemis and Apollo, Zeus's children by the Titan goddess Leto. They were mythologically born on the island of Delos, where they really did have a massive temple. Artemis is conventionally presented as a young woman, forever a virgin, and patron of the wilderness and nature, especially wild animals and hunting. Famously, she was also a patron of chastity, except in many, many temples where she was actually the guardian of childbirth and children in general, or in at least one temple where she was the many-breasted fertility goddess. In general, the name Artemis really seems to have been assimilated into many different traditions of the Greek world, but most famously, she would violently defend the chastity of not only herself, but the band of nymphs and girls she traveled with. Her brother, Apollo, was the polar opposite, constantly chasing nymphs and women in order to seduce and/or assault them. He was also the patron of the arts, poetry, music, domesticated animals, and other human innovations, the opposite of wilderness. Their only real shared quality as siblings is that Apollo, too, was a patron of youth, in his case, young men and adolescent boys. He was also associated with plagues and remedies, prophecy and magic. Right around our current point in the narrative, these twins became associated with the moon and the sun, respectively. But that is still taking hold, and for centuries the celestial bodies were actually considered to be older Titanic deities called Selene and Helios, the literal words for moon and sun. Apollo's son, as in offspring, was Asclepius, also a very popular god in the Hellenistic period, to the degree that one of the first Greek buildings constructed in Ecbatana was a temple to Asclepius, which Alexander tore down after Hephaestion's death. In mythology, Asclepius is usually described as born mortal, the daughter of a human woman and the god Apollo, but also with a natural aptitude for medicine. This was so powerful that Asclepius even cured death in some stories. And in those tales, Hades accused the demigod doctor of stealing souls away from the afterlife. So, Zeus killed him. But then Zeus made Asclepius a god of medicine and healers at Apollo's request. Because you can't go around raising the dead, but it is impressive. Asclepius spread far and wide with the Macedonian conquests, and his temples doubled as hospitals, while his priests were typically trained as physicians. Several figures in Achaemenid history, notably including Theseus and possibly the earlier Democedes, were likely trained in Asclepion temples. And that brings me to the last pair of gods on this list. Undoubtedly two of the most popular Greek gods, especially in the Hellenistic era. First, we have the easier of the two, the ever-famous Heracles, known a little bit better by his Roman name, Hercules, though you could probably guess that. Like Asclepius, Heracles was born as the mortal hero, in this case a son of Zeus and a mortal queen, from an incident where Zeus disguised himself as her real husband and slept with her without telling her. Heracles' mortal life is basically the blueprint for the later Western European questing hero archetype. He is beset by tragedy, repeatedly wrathful, quick to anger, absurdly strong and capable in battle, and constantly doing fetch quests for kings or gods to fight deadly monsters. The most famous example are the 12 labors of Heracles. His stories include multiple marriages and affairs with many women and men alike. He was claimed as the mythological ancestor of kings all over the Greek world, to include the Augeads of Macedon like Philip and Alexander. Very early Greek myths, like the Odyssey, let Heracles go to the underworld as a mortal soul after a painful death by way of poisoned shirt. But by the classical period, that story had fallen by the wayside. In the more popular version, Zeus elevates his most famous son to godhood after death, and he became the god of... being Heracles, basically. As a god, Heracles was coasting on the rule of cool. He was the best of everything masculine in Greek culture, from hunting to athletics to warfare to just kinda heroism in general. Basically, Heracles was so popular that they worshipped him as a god just for the sake of it. So, I started writing this next section and I ran into a problem. Our final god is way, way too complicated to try explaining all of why he's important to know, or all of the different ways that Hellenistic religion understood him. There is going to be a dedicated episode at some point. Fortunately, we are gonna kill off so many kings. But for now, here is the abbreviated version of Dionysus. One of the biggest problems with describing this god is that he might have been the most interpretatio graecad deity of all time. Dionysus was a bit of a grab bag of deified traits in Greek mythology already, and likely a god the Greeks adopted from foreign merchants. It is borderline impossible to figure out what was part of his mythos that made an easy comparison, and what was added to the story of Dionysus because of those comparisons after the fact. By way of a weird middle stop comparison in Phrygia, Dionysus was even identified as a manifestation of Yahweh, as in the Jewish and Christian god. Typically, Dionysus was presented as looking like a young man, accompanied by an entourage of nature spirits, and always, always partying. He was the patron of wine, viticulture, fertility, especially in the sense of male sexuality, festivals, theater, and ecstasy, to include ritually induced madness. That probably relates to the wine, but also whatever other intoxicants the Greeks were mixing into religious events, especially because he was the chief god alongside Demeter and Persephone in the Eleusinian Mysteries. He was a wrathful and clever warrior in some stories and the pinnacle of decadence in others. In some myths, Dionysus was born a god, in others, he was a mortal hero who ascended to godhood like Heracles after visiting the afterlife, and in others, he was born twice, once as a god and once as a mortal, and then became a god again. Like I said, there's a lot to unpack with this one. One of his most famous stories involved being driven mad by Hera, wandering east, getting cured by the Phrygian goddess Kublai, and then going on a wild adventure that turned into a campaign of military conquest. Either fighting everything all the way to India, or, according to Diodorus Siculus, just straight up conquering the entire world. Oh, and along the way, he was credited with inventing wine. So I guess he's Georgian now. Possibly Iranian, hard to tell. Basically, you can probably see why the people of Alexander's era liked him. Dionysus was the god of parties, orgies, oversized military campaigns, and sometimes magical benefits and blessings to his devoted adherents. Honestly, much like Heracles, he was a god of being cool, covering all the aspects of excitement and culture that Greek kings and warriors valued, which weren't included with Heracles. So like I said, Dionysus, bizarrely complicated mix of traditions that I'm going to need more time to break down. But in the meantime, I've got an AMA to do, and then we'll see when we get back to the narrative. Until then.
If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to historyofpersiapodcast.com. That's where you will find my bibliography, the Achaemenid family tree, and plenty of other things, including the support page, to financially support this project. There are all sorts of ways to do that, but most importantly, there's patreon.com/historyofpersia. You can sign up for a monthly subscription ranging from $1 to $20, and access to things like ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and discounted merchandise. Even if you don't want to subscribe, you can also visit the show's store, either through historyofpersiapodcast.com or historyofpersia.launchcart.com. You can also support this show for free by leaving a rating or review on your podcast app of choice. I always love to see your feedback, but even better than that, tell your friends to listen to the History of Persia. Share it on social media at History of Persia Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads, and just History of Persia on Twitter, and everything else that's trying to be Twitter. Thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.